Once again, here's your host, Michael Corbin.
And again, as I've mentioned tonight, we have a very, very, very important program, and we're going to be talking about something that's very, very real. And as I mentioned earlier, it's very serious because this has the potential to impact not only your health, but the health of your children and future generations to come. And this is quite an unusual mystery, and believe me, at this particular stage of the game, we're just about as mystified as you're going to be when you hear about it. So stay tuned for that. Before also, I want to go give out our phone numbers again. Our number tonight, if you want to reach my guests, is 303-537-3119, 303-537-3119, and 303-367-1116. That's how you can reach us. Now, also, since this program is now being webcasted, I'd like to invite all of you right now to go to www.carnicom.com, and I'll spell that for you. It's www.carnicom.com. We're going to be talking about this this topic tonight. There's a very interesting photograph and a story that goes with that on this website about what we're going to be talking about now. Now, let's introduce my guests. We have two of them on the line tonight. They are actually here in the Denver area tonight. And I would like to welcome to the program Dave Peterson and Clifford Carnicom. Good evening, gentlemen.
Yeah.
Thank you for being on the program.
Yes. Good evening, Michael. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Okay, I can barely hear you.
Okay, we'll work on that as we go along here. Now, Clifford, you're the gentleman that is working, doing a lot of the research on this stuff that's known as chemtrails. Now, if we could start off by acquainting the audience with what is a chemtrail.
Sure, Michael, and thank you for inviting me to be on the show tonight. I think that it's fair to admit that there is some variance and ambiguity in the definitions, but let me try to explain some of the characteristics that people would look for in us making that decision or determination.
Okay.
More in terms of characteristics. Characteristics that would be associated with a chemtrail would be, first of all, emissions from an aircraft. Usually at a high altitude, the emissions would often and normally be continuous. That means in a continuous line, often from horizon to horizon. Another characteristic would be the density of that trail. And remember, what we're contrasting this against is what would be called a contrail,
right,
which is composed of water vapor. Water vapor is expected to dissipate in a fairly short period of time, normally anywhere, say, 15 to 45 seconds. What we're speaking of is a trail that is emitted from an aircraft and does not dissipate. So this would be a third characteristic that's extremely important, and that is the persistence of the trail, its tendency to linger. Number four would be the frequent transformation of that trail into a cloud layer. It would appear initially to be forming into a cirrus cloud layer, but there is a lot of variance with these. A fifth characteristic would be that at certain times, it can be easily shown through photography that these trails emit at a location other than the engines. There are some rather remarkable photographs, these are telephotos, that show emissions of a material across the full length of the wingspan of an aircraft, where the engines of that aircraft are located in the rear alongside the fuselage. So in certain cases, it's very clear to demonstrate that the emissions are not coming from the engines. So these would be characteristics that I would say a person would associate with an aircraft, as opposed to their counterparts, which would be that of a fairly typical rapid dissipation, non-continuous, non-persistent, coming from the engines of the aircraft clearly, and following the physical behavior of water vapor, namely disappearing in a fairly short period of time.
So we have to definitely make a distinction between a contrail, which is basically a natural occurring phenomena that is emitted from the interaction of the warm jet exhaust with the cooled atmosphere up above where it's flying. Is that correct?
Absolutely, and all familiar phenomenon which we have witnessed really throughout our lives, and is nothing unexpected, is nothing unusual, and is perfectly analogous to when we take our car down the highway on a cold winter morning, and we have initial formation of
Right, okay. Now, one thing I want to bring up, and you mentioned this just now in the description of a chemtrail, one of the characteristics of it, which I find very interesting because I cannot remember ever seeing a trail coming from an airplane as it's flying above me that appeared to dissipate or, if you will, expand into what looks like, as you mentioned, a cirrus cloud. Now, with that in mind, and I'm sure that the listeners will kind of get an idea of what we're talking about because I'm sure they have seen it too because you have some very remarkable photographs on your website. And, again, that URL for that is www.carnicom.com, C-A-R-N-I-C-O-M.com. And I invite you listening to go and look at this as we interview Clifford and Dave because he's got some very interesting photographs of chemtrails or what are being called chemtrails. Now, Clifford, let's talk a little bit about, first of all, how did you get involved in this? And let's kind of lead into what you are discovering in your research.
Michael, I suppose my involvement goes in two stages. The first stage is prefaced, or let's say occurs at more of a subconscious level where I simply was not aware of the activities which were likely affecting me. And this was in the northwestern part of the United States in Montana,
okay,
where I came up with a rather unusual illness of a respiratory nature, which did not go away. The characteristics were that of a cough, persistent cough, deep-seated bronchial nature, which lingered eventually for a 2 to 3 year period and actually never did go away. And so I eventually moved to the southwestern part of the United States in Santa Fe, New Mexico, for the express purpose of improving my health, certainly as a major reason as to why I moved.
Right.
My direct involvement began on February 14th of 1999 when I took my camera outside and simply photographed that which I was observing. And what I observed in a clear fashion was a trail being emitted from an aircraft on a perfectly clear blue sunny sky. If one is familiar with the desert environment of Santa Fe, New Mexico, it's high desert and very clear skies and very low humidity. And an aircraft flew overhead, and this aircraft left a trail which satisfied all the characteristics that I'm speaking of above, with the exception of not extending from wingtip to wingtip. There is another set which commonly appears at the stabilizer region of the aircraft, the tail of the aircraft, and that's the nature of this one. Over a 15 to 20-minute period, that trail that I was observing transformed itself into a cloud layer and within 20 minutes changed a perfectly clear sky into a cirrus, partially occluded sky. And that was my first direct involvement. And since that point, I have embarked, let's say, on an endeavor to collect additional photographs, fairly high quality with telephoto lenses, to remove any ambiguity or doubt as to what is occurring. And that effort has continued now for close to a year and a half.
Okay. Now, I personally can attest to some of this because, as I told you, when we were together talking about this, that I myself have had an unusual cold, if you will, something that, kind of like flu-like, if you will, that has persisted for almost 3 months now with me. And I was first acquainted with the notion of chemtrails last year when I started hearing about it popping up in various places. And it was at that time that I started noticing this phenomenon that you're describing of emissions from what appears to be jet engines or jets flying overhead that dissipate or expand into what look like cirrus clouds. And the thing I'm wondering is this. Now, you got involved in this, and your research has taken you into a variety of different places. And I want to kind of focus on, for example, we're going to talk about samples and that kind of thing, because I know you've got something about the biological components identified. We'll cover that when we come back from this break, okay?
Sure will. Thank you very much, Mike.
Okay, our number tonight is 303-537-3119, 303-537-3119. My guests tonight are Clifford Carnicom and Dave Peterson. We're talking about chemtrails. And we're going to find out a lot more about them. Some of this stuff is really absolutely amazing. We'll get back to that in just a moment. Welcome back, my guests tonight, Clifford Carnicum and Dave Peterson. We're talking about chemtrails. Clifford, what I'd like to do in this segment is to talk about, you know, the linkages that have occurred here. Where did we start seeing the linkage between or the association between the potential possibility that these trails emitted by the planes are chemical, biological-type things possibly, and flu-like symptoms that the CDC has been reporting on?
Michael, I think there's two parts of the answer to that question. In terms of the, let's say, physical manifestation of these on the ground and when that occurred, in the tail of November in 1999, there were two samples that were brought to my attention. These two samples were directly correlated with aircraft activity prior to the collection. In one case, the samples were seen falling from the sky. The first sample occurred in eastern Oregon and the second in the Sacramento area. Two separate parties at two separate times were, let's say, affected enough by the appearance of this material on the ground and or in the air to collect it. And looking for a place to send to, they became familiar with my name as a research person in this field. So at the end of November, I was the recipient of two samples from two separate parties from two separate locations at two separate times. Neither of these parties knew one another and still don't, to my knowledge. I began an analysis of that material at that time and was immediately, let's say, struck by some unusual qualities or characteristics of that material. These characteristics are best summarized by describing the size of this material. The material is composed of fibers. It's a fibrous material, white in nature. And I was struck to put this material under a microscope as soon as possible. And the most, let's say, the most prominent characteristic which shows up immediately is the size of these fibers. These fibers are incredibly small. I have eventually had them measured as being less than 1 micron in width. 1 micron is an astounding number. To give the audience a frame of reference or a comparison, a human hair is roughly in the neighborhood of 60 to 80 microns in thickness. A line of cotton thread, is roughly 10 microns in thickness. And a spider web is approximately 7 microns in width, at least the ones I have measured. The material I am speaking of is less than 1 micron in width. There are little to no fibers of my knowledge, natural fibers of this size. Asbestos might be the nearest candidate, which should be in the neighborhood of 2 to 3 microns thick. So the size of this material, thickness of it, is certainly an unusual characteristic which warrants further investigation. A second characteristic of this material is that it is extremely adhesive. It's very difficult to separate contact with the material once it is made. If you're using a microscope slide and a needle, it would often take 2 to 3 passes to get this fiber to adhere to a glass slide. And a third characteristic would be what would best be described as a synthetic nature having a wavy form. And this is a microscopically wavy form, something that you cannot see with your eye. But I describe it as kinky or wavy in nature at a microscopic level. So these are three physical characteristics which appeared, which separated this material as being unique and, let's say, warranting further investigation. I hope that helps with the first part of your question.
Right, it does.
In terms of a physical form. And I would like to say, you know, in casual passing, that what we're speaking of here is not something of a speculative nature. This is not something that needs to be wondering whether or not it's occurring or not. This is a tangible phenomenon which all listeners within the United States can observe. In terms of the appearance of these trails, this is not something imaginary. The physical material, of course, is certainly of a more rare nature. But this is something, I'm a scientist by background, and I use those methods, and they can apply here. The second part of your question in respect to health issues, we can only, let's say, look for correlations and patterns in the world around us. And one of those patterns which is appearing is the frequency and incidence of illness across the nation associated with this aerial activity. And it is worthwhile to investigate the official sources of information on illness reported on a regular basis, actually weekly or biweekly, by the Centers for Disease Control.
Right.
And that agency reports on a regular basis the frequency of what is called influenza. And what's interesting is the terms describing illness have now generalized themselves and become more generic and broadened themselves. And we frequently note the inclusion of the term flu-like illness now in these, let's say, categorizations. And the CDC reports statistics on the frequency and incidence of influenza and flu-like illness across the United States on a regular basis. What is of much interest on the numbers of these reports is that really for the majority of 1999, the American populace was at an epidemic, what is classified as an epidemic level, which starts around 8%, somewhere around 8% of the population being admitted formally into a hospital or a doctor's office with this, diagnosis of influenza or flu-type illness.
Okay.
A epidemic level has sustained itself for a majority of 1999. In the year 2000, the current year, it's especially fascinating because, once again, we are at epidemic levels on a continuous basis, and that 8% has jumped to a 12%. A percentage point on a national basis is a huge number in terms of magnitude of people that are affected. If a person looks at the charge for this, and I have a link to that on the website, it's really astronomical in terms of the way that this is deviating for the current year. What is even of further interest is that of that percentage of people, by the way, these are people that die. This is the mortality rate. What
right.
It's saying is of those people that are admitted to the hospital with influenza or the generic flu-type illness term, let's say 8% of those people die. That's what the number refers to. And so that jump is from 8 to 12%.
That's quite a few people, too, on a national scale.
It's astronomical in terms of its implication, in terms of numbers of people that is basically unreported in the news. And what is of further interest is that of the people that are dying, the numbers are showing that literally 1%, a very small percent of the people, are actually dying from influenza. What this means is that the majority of people that are reported as dying are dying from an illness which is falling under a generic term of flu-like. That's actually the fascinating statistic that is now emerging as one studies this data.
Makes you wonder what they're doing.
Right, and what exactly the term means.
Exactly.
And the appearance, you know, if readers just become observant, first of all, you observe the sky and then listen. Notice the inclusion and appearance of broad-based use of the term flu-like illness.
Right. Okay, we're taking another break, so hold that thought. We'll get back to that, too, when we come back to that flu-like illness and what that means or what that potentially might mean with this data that my guest Clifford Carnicum is collecting. Is Clifford Carnicum and Dave Peterson. We're talking about chemtrails. Now, this is a very interesting, a very serious subject because from what we are hearing from Clifford tonight, data has been collected that indicates that there is a biological agent involved in all of this. And, of course, we are basically he's basically collecting the evidence, and he's going to be soliciting for assistance in helping to analyze this data in hopes of trying to identify exactly what it is that's coming out of the sky, that may be coming from the output of jets. And what those jets are, we don't know. We've got a pretty good idea from his documentation and stuff. And, again, the website is www.carnicom.com. That's carnicom.com. And I invite you to go to that website while we're talking tonight so you can see the thing that's going on here. Clifford, what I'd like to do is pick up on this segment now, and let's talk about the biological components that have been identified in these samples that have been collected?
Sure, Michael. I'd like to mention, if I can,
sure,
that I have no desire or any goal to fabricate anything. I'm actually only seek the truth on this issue and to have information fully disclosed to the American public.
Right.
In an effort in, to continue that purpose, at the time that I analyzed these materials, let's say it was found difficult to have that material analyzed professionally by anyone. We actually did have involvement with one laboratory in the southwestern United States that delivered results which were very easily proven to be false for anyone even slightly knowledgeable in chemical or analysis techniques. And so that was one of the first flags that came up, was that there was some difficulty in trying to get this material analyzed professionally.
Right.
Because of that, and my general method of directness, David Peterson and I both made a mutual decision to send the material in question, a portion of that physical sample, directly to Carol M. Browner by certified mail. Carol M. Browner is the administrator of the United States Environmental Protection Agency.
Okay.
That material was sent to her to basically get the question answered directly. What is this material? Please analyze it and provide your results to the American public. So I'd like to be clear that my intent is for open disclosure, open examination of the material in question. This occurred on January 20th of this year, the year 2000. That material was acknowledged by signed and certified mail receipt. Now, what is interesting is that there has been no adequate response from Carol M. Browner to the questions and issues that have been posed to her. She did, about roughly a month and a half later, send a reply letter, and in that letter, she never acknowledged the existence or the receipt of the materials received and deflected our inquiry to a subsidiary division of that Environmental Protection Agency, and basically returned a pat letter to us describing the characteristics of normal contrails, which we have just referred to earlier.
Right.
In fact, many of the official responses that come back are of that nature, to give a brief description of normal contrails and to assure the inquirer that whatever he or she is seeing is normal also.
Mm-hmm.
So with that background, that this material does exist in the hands of the United States government with a request to analyze that, myself and other researchers have been motivated to continue our investigations in the meantime. And actually a rather important, let's say, discovery or analysis breakthrough came through within the last week and a half on this subject. And that is that this material that I'm speaking of was placed under observation of a high-quality commercial microscope, a very high quality that would magnify in the order of anywhere from 10 to 20,000 times. And in addition to all of those characteristics which I have described earlier, which are in themselves quite unique and provide a case for further investigation, for the first time, because of the quality of this microscope, there were biological components that were identified in this sample. These biological components consist primarily of red blood cells. These were identified by, let's say, a competent individual who will remain anonymous, but has provided the imagery. And by the way, this imagery is on record and has been distributed across numerous locations in the United States and is protected from destruction. There is the appearance of numerous red blood cells within these fibers. The cells do not occur within the fibers per se. They are, let's say, interspersed amongst the fibers, usually as isolated individual cells. And one might raise the question of whether or not there's a possibility of contamination.
Right.
And that question is best answered by the fact that, number one, these biological cells are found in both samples that I refer to. One is more dense than the other. But both samples, which remember come from two different parties at two different locations at two different times, exhibit the appearance or the existence of these cells. What is truly remarkable is that in addition to isolated blood cells identified, there was the appearance in one of these samples of two separate clusters of red blood cells. It's actually rather a phenomenal event to occur because this will not occur in nature, as it will be seen that these blood cells are in a systematic pattern. They're organized. It appears as a let's say, a direct product of creation, human creation, rather than a fact of nature. And the best analogy of the appearance of these cells would be something on the order of a cluster of grapes or a strawberry in terms of its shape and the clustering.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt right there, Clifford. Hold that thought because we're going to take another break.
Sure.
And I want to mention, too, that the photograph that Clifford is describing is on his website at www.carnicom.com/contrails.htm. You can get a photograph or look at this and see what he's talking about. And when we come back from this break, we're going to also continue in this discussion about the red blood cells. There's also more information he has about why it is so remarkable that these are found in there, and they just don't belong. They just shouldn't be there. But they're there. Frank, we were talking about this sample that Clifford has had analyzed, and it, first of all, displayed a very unusual constituency, being comprised of red and white blood cells as well as unidentified cell types. But not only that, there's a lot more to the mystery, and I'll let you go ahead and continue where we left off, Clifford.
Yes. Hi, Michael. I guess it would also be worthwhile to say that it has taken close to a year and a half to get to this point in the research, and so it's not a quick and easy process. And it's only through a combination of events and circumstances that as much as is known now has occurred. The most recent analysis of this material actually required an unusual condition, which it's significant in terms of it's not a likely thing to have happened. But if you follow the description of the blood cells which have been identified, the basic and intrinsic nature of these cells appears to be of a freeze-dried or a desiccated nature, and they actually are essentially not even visible under normal circumstances,
right,
even under the high-quality microscope view that I speak of.
Uh-huh.
And if these were put under the slide with some water, they still were not apparent. And it's only with the inclusion of a particular type of oil that is frequently used in microscopy called immersion oil. And I'm not a microscope, let's say, professional. But the inclusion of immersion oil is what has allowed these cells to become visible. Other oils were tried, and they simply did not have the same effect of reconstituting these cells. I should also say now that the limit is being reached even with this high-quality microscope in terms of the assessments that can be made. I will assume that a professional in the field of medicine or biology may be able to enlighten us with some additional information. However, the additional point of curiosity is that these cells apparently are expected to be very smooth on the outside surface. And it was observed under the highest levels of magnification available that the surface of these cells appeared to be rough in nature, as though they may have been modified in some way. This opens up a whole range of possibilities, and however, me being really not likely to be more of a speculative nature, we simply have to admit the limits of the technology that has been used and to indicate the need for even more sophisticated analysis of this material or demands placed on Carol Ann Browner of the EPA to perform the same analysis.
Okay, now let me interrupt you right there, Clifford. We're at the end of our first hour. What I want to do is we're going to take a break, and we'll rejoin at 6 after the hour. But that'll give you some time for a break, take some coffee or whatever. And when we come back from this break, I want to pick up what kinds of things you want to do and where your research is headed in ways that people who listen to this program can possibly get involved in helping to get to the bottom of this big mystery, okay?
Thank you very much.
Okay. Stay tuned, everyone. We'll be back after this break, and we'll rejoin at 6 minutes after the hour. And welcome back tonight, Clifford Carnicum and Dave Peterson, who are joining me from Denver. And, gentlemen, thank you for being on the program tonight.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Michael.
And, Dave, I want to welcome you and also encourage you to jump in at any time. I'll have you in just a moment to explain your role with Clifford and what you're doing, because as I understand it, you guys are working together trying to generate some grassroots interest among people to try and get involved in helping to identify what is going on here. And I think that's very, very important. And, of course, as you mentioned during the first hour, Clifford, you sent a sample to Carol M. Browner, who is the administrator of the United States EPA, and you have had no response from her, nor even an acknowledgement that she received these samples. Is that correct?
That's correct. I would say no adequate response. I did mention that a letter did come back about a month and a half ago. That letter was woefully insufficient, was a deflection to a subsidiary agency, and did not address the issues originally addressed to her.
Right. Now, Clifford, let's kind of swing our focus now upon what your efforts are. And as you mentioned again in the first hour, too, your policy is to be open and direct with everything that you're doing concerning this, which I think is absolutely the best way to take this. But, you know, as most people will know, listening to the program, these kinds of causes are essentially the best kind of way to handle it is at the grassroots. And therefore, you're able to solicit the assistance of people who are qualified in different areas, disciplines, scientific backgrounds, and that type of thing. Let's talk about what your goal is with this this whole project.
Sure, Michael. And if I can, I would like to preface this discussion with emphasizing the seriousness of this issue that we're speaking of.
Right.
I'm not a person who historically is an activist. I'm not a person who is historically involved with items even what would be generally classified as a conspiratorial nature. My history and background, if one were to investigate it, would find that I'm actually a rather quiet person. I have a history of employment with the federal government at a professional technical level for approximately 15 years. And it was never my desire to actually become, let's say, a focal point of such a serious issue in a public forum. But I am motivated to do that simply by my judgment of what is right for us as a nation and for our welfare. I do classify what is occurring as a crime without hesitation. I made that judgment immediately because it was quite obvious and apparent to me that judgment has not changed in the slightest since February of 1999. There are crimes being committed. There is not a question of whether or not they are occurring. It is a matter of seeking accountability for what is occurring and raising the awareness and involvement of the American public on this issue. So,
if I may interrupt you right there just for a second before you go into the next thing, is I want to kind of back up what you just said, too, because one thing I want to point out to our listening audience as well is that we know that through past release of information and congressional hearings that some, departments or agencies under the federal government have actively engaged in the experimentation of biowarfare materials on unsuspecting, unwitting American citizens, as well as other people in the world. And so this is not exactly an unprecedented phenomena where you have a situation where, you know, for example, the church hearings back in the middle 70s, and you guys were mentioning something about 1977 relating to Dugway. So we have a situation here where we know historically that this kind of activity has occurred in the past.
You're absolutely right, Michael, because if one does examine the historical record available to us, there is a precedent. There were hearings held in 1977, headed by Ted Kennedy at that time,
right,
which fully acknowledged the existence of biological testing occurring on citizens of the United States without their informed consent. And informed consent is truly the critical issue here. That same phrase pops up in the 1977 hearings, and it is openly acknowledged that this is a crime of the highest nature, that tests were conducted on U.S. citizens without their knowledge, and the dates and the specific agents that were used are disclosed in this report, and that is the function of those hearings. It is also of interest to note that those hearings, which were held in 1977, cover periods of time roughly from the 1950s up through 1970 or so. In other words, there is a lag between the time of the hearings and the events which are being analyzed.
Right.
So one can only infer that what we're speaking of now is, let's say, long overdue for hearings on this subject, as well as those which may yet to be discovered in the interim period. In terms of direction for the future, in terms of goals, I would say two main objectives exist, at least on the simplest level, and have existed from the beginning. And the first one is disclosure. And by disclosure, I mean full disclosure. There is a need to lay out on the table exactly what is happening, why it is happening, who is doing it, and for what purpose. If we are to remain a free society, the pinnacle and the basis of our society is that of free information flow and citizen involvement in our government.
Okay.
So full disclosure at all levels is certainly a primary objective. Second would be the issue of accountability. If any of us were to commit a crime, we are to be held accountable. The government is us. And if there are crimes that are being committed, no matter at what level they are being committed, there is an issue of accountability. We have recently undergone as a nation a set of impeachment hearings, and we repeatedly heard the phrase, the rule of law, and whether or not the rule of law is to prevail. For us to survive as a nation, it is simply a fact that the rule of law must prevail.
I agree with you 100%. Tonight on our minds is pestilence falling from the sky? And as you're listening tonight to this program, Clifford Carnicum and Dave Peterson have got an incredible amount of evidence that indicates that something indeed unusual is occurring in the skies over the United States as well as around the world. Clifford, let's go back to our discussion now about what your goals are and what you're interested in doing.
Yes, Michael, thank you. To return to that topic, I stated some generalities that were needed in terms of disclosure and accountability. In terms of more specific steps on the agenda right now, based upon the evidence and information that's available, these are what I would define as objectives. And these objectives are not my objectives. I believe and I think that these objectives should be objectives of the people of this country.
Right.
There is a need for serious involvement and escalated involvement in this issue. And in terms of specific items on the agenda that I would advocate, first and number one on the list would be media presentation. And I want to thank you and commend you for taking a sincere and honest making an honest and sincere effort to make this information available to the American public, because it is quite clear, if anyone wishes to examine this issue and the role of the media, it is quite clear that there has been a lid on this information, a damper, a ceiling on the release of information on this subject in all possible ways at the highest levels across the nation. If one examines where information flows on this subject, it is the Internet. And the primary reason that is the case is because the Internet remains as one source of, let's say, relatively free flow for information. And so the Internet, at this point, still remains the primary medium through which information circulates. There are now literally hundreds of websites that have developed on this subject, primarily from individuals, when you speak of the grassroots movement. That's where it has emerged. These people were not working in cooperation with one another. They have all emerged individually and spontaneously.
Right.
And you can certainly see the foundation for a vast network of communication that needs to take place. One of the needs certainly is to break through beyond the Internet medium to the spoken word, to the vocal word, such as you are doing, where people can listen and talk and see what is happening.
Right.
So media exposure is paramount on the list. A second item would be organization at a national level of citizen involvement. The development, the formation of a national lobby force, which eventually, if need be, can march onto the White House lawn and have the voice that the nation deserves. The third item on the agenda from my side would be the participation of professionals in the field. If the listeners or readers observe on the website that I maintain, they'll notice what's called an open invitation, and that open invitation is extended to literally any citizen in this country that challenges the veracity, the truth of the information that I am presenting. And the invitation seeks a national disclosure and examination of the evidence that I'm presenting on a national news show or its equivalent.
Uh-huh.
That invitation requires the participation of experts in the fields of numerous professional fields, chemistry, biology, medicine, physics, meteorology, aviation, forensics. This is serious participation which is required. This is not a bunch of people that need to get together and give their opinions. There is serious analytical work which needs to be done. The ground samples that I have referred to, the point of research demands an electron microscope to analyze that material to the depth that it requires. So professional involvement with individuals that are willing to sign their name, which is extremely important. We as a people need to commit towards seeking the truth and to operate in a mode of full disclosure. And the next item would be, let's say, the legal pursuit, or the pursuit of justice in the legal system, that which is right and wrong, and to establish that in a court of law. It involves the participation of environmental groups, which, by the way, I will say, I will openly say, I believe has been woefully inadequate. If you look at the responses which have occurred, or lack of responses which has occurred from major environmental groups across this nation, you will find them non-existent in a serious fashion.
Right.
That's a fascinating phenomenon in itself.
I agree.
And opens up a whole gamut of questions as to where are they. As I say, this topic, this issue can be discussed literally from an environmental standpoint alone of the obscuration and the influence and effect upon our skies overhead and their damaging effects to visibility at the very least, and the effects of sunlight and for our health.
Right.
And a last item, and when I finish with this, I'd like to turn it over to Dave, if I can, for just a minute in terms of introducing himself and suggesting some ways that we can start.
Okay.
But a last item on that list would be that which has been mentioned of accountability by the responsible parties, wherever that falls.
Okay. Clifford, hold that. We got to take another break.
Sure.
And when we come back, we'll finish up with the disclosure, and we'll introduce Dave and get on with
sure,
that.
Michael.
Okay. 303-537-3119, 303-537-3119. We're discussing a very fascinating topic tonight, the chemtrails, and what they are and what they seem to be doing to us, and it's not good. Stay tuned, and please don't touch your dials, or in this case, don't click your browser. So, talking tonight with Clifford Carnicum and Dave Peterson, and we're discussing the chemtrail phenomena, and if you're listening, and you can go to their website while we speak, you'll find very, very interesting information there. That website address is www.carnicom.com. That's www.carnicom.com. And welcome back, gentlemen.
Thank you, Michael.
Is there, Clifford, is there anything else we want to say on disclosure before we turn it over to Dave?
Michael, I'd just like to, maybe to avoid confusion, to mention on the website that that is also, you know, primarily my business website, which started, and that this issue has been added on to it. So when users go to that front page, they will see a link which is very clear and very obvious on that front page, which leads to the additional information on this issue.
Okay.
And then second, in terms of items to do or items on the agenda, users, let's say I'd like to start by saying users are welcome to register their protest and involvement at initial level with an on-form letter that I have available, which basically submits a letter of protest to five top federal officials of this country, including William Jefferson Clinton, the elected president, and as well as Carolyn Browner and other top agencies of likely involvement, or let's say accountability. So there is an online letter that is available for readers and or listeners or users of the Internet to submit their name and address. To become at least initially registered, there is inadequate staff and time to handle this problem right now, and that's why we do need the literally the nation involved. But that's at least the first step. And then in terms of more formal steps that can be made to, let's say, offer professional services, legal services, I'd like to turn this over to Dave right now and give him an opportunity to introduce himself and also give some contact information. Dave is an invaluable person in terms of his assistance in this project. Most, if not all, of what has been learned has been through the efforts of individuals in this country who have been willing to stake their time and energy because of the importance of this subject. And Dave Peterson is such an individual and has helped tremendously in terms of organizing actions and bringing people together. And so I'd like to turn this discussion to Dave so that he can give some information that will be helpful for contacts and give him a more fair chance to speak than maybe I've given him thus far.
Okay, go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, good evening, Michael, and thank you for having me tonight on your show.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah, you bet. It's an honor. So I live in Aspen, Colorado, and I had the good fortune to meet Clifford down in Santa Fe last summer. And since then, we've worked relatively closely, speaking almost daily on combining our efforts to get some things to happen regarding the subject and its exposure. I want to give the audience some contacts where they can get more information or like Clifford said, offer their services to help get the word out. The first would be my email address, and that would be at dcp@sopris, that's SOPRIS.net.
Why don't you repeat that one more time?
Yes, it's Delta Charlie Papa, or dcp@sopris.net.
Okay.
And the next piece of information would be a mailing address, and that would be to the Chemtrail Research Fund, Post Office Box 2921, Aspen, Colorado, 81. are accepting donations also to help offset the expenses involved in getting this information out there.
Okay. If I may ask one of the two of you to respond to this question, and I think it's very important we touch on this again because I know it's been hit on during the program, but why is it so important that people get involved in this? What is the implications of this?
Well, I'll address that, Michael. The reason people need to get involved is this. Right now, there's a small handful of people that are active in that, I would say, exposing this issue to the American public. I believe there's an awareness in the thousands that definitely acknowledge this is happening, or higher, hundreds of thousands. However, it seems the burden's been put on certain individuals like Clifford and myself, which is fine, but each person is a part of our democracy,
right.
And they have a stake in this. And if you realize what is truly happening and the seriousness of this issue, which involves the air we breathe, I believe it is paramount for each individual to contact their elected officials, starting at the local level, their environmental protection people and such, and push them for answers. Hopefully, that'll push the local officials into going to the state and national levels so we can get some answers and some accountability on what's going on. But I believe there's power in numbers.
I agree. Safety in numbers, too.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, we're going to take another break. When we come back, we'll get more comments on this and other ways that people can get involved in trying to help get to the bottom of this mystery. And by the way, gentlemen, I want to commend you also on your persistence and what you're doing, because I know from meeting you both face-to-face that not only are you tired, but you're very determined, and I think that's great that you're continuing to push onward, because this is a very important issue for everyone involved. 303-537-3119, 537-3119, area code 303 is our number. Clifford Carnicom and Dave Peterson are my guests tonight. We're talking about chemtrails. Oh, what a mess. I kind of call it pestilence from the sky. It's a very nasty business. We're talking tonight about chemtrails, and we've had a very, very remarkable two-hour discussion concerning all of this with my guests, Clifford Carnicom and Dave Peterson. Gentlemen, I'm curious. What I think we should probably do at some point is also maybe kind of just give people an idea of the general symptoms of what, because I think it's important for people listening to recognize that what they might think of as just a persistent cough or a cold could, in fact, be related to this.
Yeah, I'll take that one, Michael. It's David. Typically what people experience is sore throat, cough, persistent cough, recurring sore throat. It tends to be related to the upper respiratory tract, sometimes developing into bronchitis, sometimes pneumonia. We're also seeing quite an increase in allergies with people who have existing allergies.
Right.
They're expanded, and people who have never experienced allergies are now experiencing allergies. And there's a lot of sort of side symptoms that are showing up, too, that are a bit hard to explain in the form of dizziness, some gastrointestinal problems, and also migraine-type headaches. So I would say, for myself anyway, mine started with recurring flu-like symptoms, and that's what actually originally got me involved in this whole situation. And right now, as we speak, I'm experiencing a sore throat due to the heavy spray activity I believe we're experiencing here in Denver today. But that's the symptom I tend to experience when there is heavy spray activity. I believe it is directly related to this.
I think,
and that's what people are experiencing all over, where they see this, these designs and crisscrosses and X's and cirrus-type clouds in the sky. In the wake of that, there seems to be an increase in this respiratory problems.
Disturbances, if you will.
Yes.
Yeah, I kind of like to relate to the audience, too, what I experienced, kind of like my firsthand testimony of something bizarre, because as we discussed when we were talking earlier today, you know, I know my body very well, and I'm in tune with it, and I know that whatever this is highly unusual for me, because I'm generally a healthy person and can throw off a cold in about 10 days, like most people can. And I came down with this on the 16th of March, and it started off with kind of a general feeling of, you know, I was lethargic and started feeling a little dizzy and strange. And I started with a dry cough, which rapidly blew into this full-blown involvement in my lower respiratory area, you know, the bronchial tubes and everything. But I had an undulating fever. I mean, it was the most bizarre thing I've ever had. My fever would peak out at 102, would drop to 99, shoot back up to 102, and it did this for 5 days. I was in the hospital three times, two rounds of a pretty aggressive antibiotic, and even to this day now, this is what, the 13th of May, which is now clearly May, March, April, May, almost 3 months, or 2 months at least, that I've had this, and as I was telling you guys, it's kind of recurring now because the last couple of days, the congestion in the nose and the throat and the cough have increased, and I've never had anything like this.
Yes, Michael, if I can give another personal example, which is occurring right now,
yeah,
and that is that my wife has now come down with a case of apparent bronchitis or something of that nature.
Right.
Now, it's interesting to realize that we live in a desert environment, Santa Fe, New Mexico, which has an average humidity roughly in the level of 30% or less. And her illness is rather severe as it's occurring now.
Right.
And it's completely out of character with both the environment as well as her historical record of illness also. And, you know, if people actually begin inquiring on a broader nature, it's really rather surprising the number of people and the extent of the population which is often reporting, let's say, a chronic condition of ill health, which is certainly not characteristic or representative of us as a whole, and it almost seems to be reaching a point where illness is now accepted as a part of our life.
And that's very, very, very bizarre, and I know exactly what you're talking about because, you know, a lot of people that I've talked to that have had this are pretty much just resigned to the fact that whatever this is, it's going to be around for a while, and they might as well just get used to it.
Right. And
that's not good.
Yes, and by the history, the sad fact is that they seem to be right.
Let me ask you this. Would an emergency room physician, you know, when you go to the hospital or to a family doctor to be treated, would they have any occasion to basically know what's going on, or are they as puzzled by this as we are?
Well, I'm not certainly a medical expert by any stretch of the imagination, so this may be more speculative than we might desire, but at least in my experience in the fields of technical professions and such that I have worked and studied, all professions have a range of, let's say, familiarity.
Right.
Those events, those experiences which have been categorized, which have been classified, that which they are familiar with. If something falls outside of that range, that sphere of influence, I think it is frequently, let's say, a common action to simply not categorize it because it's not known, to apply a generic term to it.
Is that where this flu-like symptom comes from that the CDC uses as a category?
That's certainly my opinion at this stage, Michael, is that it is a generic term which has evolved to encompass a wide variety of illnesses which cannot be classified or diagnosed according to standard and historical medical practice.
Well, you know, that's the thing I noticed, too, because when I was at the hospital on the three occasions, I was seen in the emergency room by three different physicians, and I queried them, what is this? And none of them could really give me a definitive answer. They couldn't even identify whether it was a bacterial or a virological infection. But, you know, they were certain of one thing, and that is that they've seen a lot of it.
Exactly. And so in that sense, it does not surprise me, because it seems as though that's the arena that we're in. If we're in a set of new events, new phenomena, which are now occurring, it's not unreasonable to think that there would be new consequences.
Right. Okay. Well, we're going to take our last break, and when we come back, we'll get, again, some closing comments. And also, David will give out information again, how you can reach these gentlemen to get more information or how you can get involved. We're looking for doctors, lawyers, people who have disciplines in chemistry and physics and all of those different things, because, so, as you heard Clifford mention, some very aggressive and sophisticated analysis must be done in order to make a determination as to what we're dealing with here and hopefully find a way to stop it.
Now back to your host, Michael Corbett.
And again, welcoming my guests tonight, Clifford Connercombe and Dave Peterson. We're talking about chemtrails. And, gentlemen, real quick, we don't have much time left in this program. We've got a caller off air who called and wanted to know about how you made the connection between the samples coming from a plane. Can you cover that real quick?
Sure, Michael. One has to observe. I attempt to do my best to not draw conclusions which are warranted.
Okay.
Let's say this. You have an individual who observes unusual aerial activity of the type that we described earlier, satisfying all of these conditions. Immediately after, let's say within a few hours, in an open field on the outskirts of town, this individual finds this white fibrous material across this field and on the vegetation. That would be case number one.
Okay.
Case number two, an individual is driving down the highway. They also observe and record mentally the appearance of unusual aerial activity satisfying the conditions that we have satisfied earlier.
All right.
This individual observes fibrous material floating through the sky while driving. This individual notes, records, and photographs material on the ground, on the highway, in the adjacent fields of the nature that we describe. Let's say these individuals were reasonable in making a, let's say, direct correlation between the existence of these aircraft immediately prior and at the time of collection.
Okay.
It's also fair to say that there have been video tapes recorded, and I have seen these. Unfortunately, this particular camera person was very poor and technically and was very, very jerky with the camera. But there are videos, let's say video, that I have personally seen that shows the same thing to the level of the aircraft in the sky and the material falling through the sky. It's of a fibrous nature. Actually, very difficult to detect with the human eye until the light hits it, right?
Right.
And then also on the ground. So, you know, this is the observational evidence, which is available, which substantiates, let's say, the claim that there's a case for serious investigation.
Very good, and that's very reasonable. Okay, we're about out of time. Dave, give out the information again real quick, how people can reach you guys.
Yeah, they can contact myself at DCP. At Sopris, SOPRIS.net.
Okay.
And or mail me directly at the Chemtrail Research Fund, P.O. Box 2921, Aspen, Colorado, 81612.
Very good.
Email can also be sent through the website, Michael.
Okay, very good. And I want to thank you guys for being on the program. Now, one thing I want to mention to the listeners, watch our website at www.paranetinfo.com, and also your website at www.carnicom.com, because in the coming up future, we're going to do a 30-minute segment every week in addition to this program, kind of like an update on the chemtrail research as it progresses. Again, thank you very much to Clifford Connercombe and Dave Peterson for being on the program tonight. Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.
And good luck to you, and we hope we'll get to the bottom of this.